Well, we saw that operators in a CFD, first of all, fall into families, and according to where they stand in their in the tree of their family, we define them as primaries. So these were the operators that has that had lowest dimension in their conformal family. And then we had the descendants. Which, as we saw, you can obtain from the, I guess, when I write going up. So you start with your primary, and by acting with derivatives, you construct the descendants, and so on. And for a given primary, there's an infinite number of descendants because I can take an infinite number of derivatives. And we said that the properties of, since the descendants are just derivatives of primaries, the properties of the correlation functions of the CFT are completely known once you know the, those for the primaries, because for the descendants, all that you have to do is just take derivatives of the correlators of the primaries.
Okay?
And in this lecture, what we want to see is, we also see how conformal transformation act on primaries. And again, since we know how they act on primaries, we know how they act on the descendants, because all that I have to do is take the derivative of the transformation for the primary. And what we will do in this lecture is to essentially use conformal symmetry, which means knowing how, using how that we know how conformal transformations act on primaries, we will determine the correlation functions, the position dependence of primaries, of correlators, of correlation functions of primaries. And we will see that actually conformal invariance gives very strong constraints on the position dependence of those correlators. And in fact, the position dependence, we will see that it's completely fixed for 2 and 3 point functions. And for 4 and higher point functions, it's written in terms of some basic conformal invariant coordinates, which will be the cross ratios. Okay, so, but before we do that, let's talk a little bit more concretely about what kind of operators we're talking about here. So, there are certain operators that are present in all conformal field theories. So one is the identity operator. It's not, it's kind of boring, but it's there because it's kind of the unit. It has dimension 0. Is there some other operator that's always present in the CFT? Irrespectively of what CFT we're talking about. There's something that we should follow from that we know how is conformal symmetry generated in a conformal field theory. So remember that I said that in a conformal field theory, the conformal currents are generated by the stress energy tensor. So any CFT must have, at the very least, the stress tensor. Because this is the guy that's responsible for generating the conformal transformations. So this is the kind of minimal set of operators that the CFT must have. And, okay, so now can someone tell me what the dimension of the stress tensor would be if we are doing a CFT in these space-time dimensions? This is not hard. Okay, there are several ways of answering this. From the stress tensor, we can construct the momentum generator, right? And what's the dimension of the momentum generator? Of momentum? Yes?
One.
One, okay. Okay. So if this guy has dimension one, this guy has dimension. This is something that by now you should be able to do in your head. So this has length dimension d minus 1, right? This has mass dimension 1. So this has mass dimension d. So the stress tensor is an operator that has conformal dimension equals d. OK, just to give you another exercise. So if another important set of operators that appear in CFT is that if you have a global continuous symmetry, like, for example, if we're studying some scalar field theory that has n components, so A goes from 1 to n, and the theory is invariant, and the theory only depends, is invariant under transformations like that, that just rotate this internal index. This has nothing to do with the space-time transformation. It's a transformation on these guys, you would get a global symmetry. So by Noether's theorem, implies that there is an associated conserved current. So if your conformal field theory has a continuous symmetry, you will have a conserved current associated to that symmetry. But so now the question is, what is the dimension of a conserved current in a CFT? Does anyone know? How do we construct the current? Let me give you a hint. So another way you could have obtained this quantity is to remember that the stress tensor we defined from the variation of the action under a small perturbation of the metric induced by the conformal transformation. So another way to think about why this guy has dimension d is that the metric is dimensionless. This guy has the length dimension d, so this guy has to be mass dimension d because the action is dimensionless. So from this logic, now we should be able to understand what's the dimension of this guy. How do we compute JMU in a given field theory? Does anyone know? And don't okay. So the simplest way of doing it is by definition, a global continuous symmetry is something that leaves the action invariant. And the global means that the parameters of the transformation are position independent. So that means that the variation of the action, if I now take my parameter of the global transformation for a moment to be position dependent, if it's position dependent, in general, it will not be invariant. But we know that if it was constant, it would be invariant by definition. So that means that you can always write the variation of the action as the integral over space-time of the variation of the epsilon is the transformation parameter. that strictly speaking, in a, for a global symmetry, it has to be constant. But here we're making it just to have a mild space-time dependence to actually precisely to fish out what the conserved current has to be. And this J mu is the conserved current. The reason this has a structure is that, first of all, if this guy is literally constant, this guy vanishes, so it's a symmetry. Or another way of saying it, I can bring this guy to the other side, and then that gives you the conservation law, okay, if epsilon is constant. So now by using the same logic, you can see that now you have a derivative here. So that means that the dimension of J is D minus 1. So the dimension of the conserved current in this space-time dimension is D minus 1. Okay. So let me write this because these guys are important objects. Is it, was this clear? I mean, so we said we got this for free or just by doing simple dimensional analysis. And many of the CFTs that we'll be interested in will also have this conserved current floating around. Okay, so now we want to see how conformal symmetry constrains the correlation function of primaries. So let's remind ourselves how primaries transform. Under conformal transformation, so we make a transformation X to X tilde. We're talking about conformal transformations, of course. And then the statement was that an operator OA of X transforms like this. Remember that we said that it transforms essentially like a density. It has this Jacobian factor times a Lorentz transformation that acts on this index of the operator, where R is a position-dependent Lorentz transformation. Remember that we said that R mu nu, let me see how I wrote it, R mu nu of X is omega of X where, remember that omega, this object here is the same as omega of X to the delta. Is the conformal, the conformal factor of the metric. Remember that when you make a transformation, you get a conformal factor. This omega is the conformal factor. And then you get here OB of X. Okay. And the statement was here that this guy is a Lorentz transformation. So that means that it satisfies, you can show from this definition that it satisfies this, where eta is the space-time metric. So where if a Lorentzian signature, it will be the Lorentzian signature. If we're in Euclidean space, it will be just the identity matrix. We're in orthogonal transformation. Okay, so now that we know how fields, and then we also wrote the formula for the infinitesimal transformation, and it had this nice interpretation. So all that we did is was expand this equation to leading order in the transformation parameters for the translation, Lorentz transformation, dilatation, and special conformal transformation. And from that, we read off that we found that the variation of the field, infinitesimal variation, can be written like that. There was one which was just purely kinematical, just a statement that you shifted the function from point A to point B. So when you take the difference, you get the derivative. And then we saw that there was a part which was a position-dependent Lorentz transformation. Where now this omega had a piece that was just the standard constant Lorentz transformation and a piece that was induced by a special conformal transformation. And then we had, okay, I don't know what sign. a dilatation piece that knew about the scaling dimension of the operator and the infinitesimal conformal factor, where this omega x was induced by a scale transformation and by a special conformal transformation. So now what we want to do is, given this knowledge that we know how the basic operators of the theory transform, we want to use conformal symmetry to determine as much as possible this type of correlation functions, a correlation function of the type, say, an n-prime function of n operators, like that. Okay, when I hear I mean by determine, I mean, right now I have not told you a specific theory that we're talking about, so this is true for any theory. So this analysis, what will tell us, is essentially what allows us to do is to solve for part of the correlator that's universal, that's the same for all conformal field theories, and then there is data in the correlator that you have to study in your own model. So each model will have a different set of those coefficients. So the goal now is to identify which coefficients are kind of inherent to a theory, that then you have to go separately and calculate them, and which part of the correlators are fixed by symmetry. Okay, and this is also useful because we will see that the dimension of the operators appears in the correlators in a very particular form. So actually that's one way of practically extracting these quantities. You look at a particular correlator, and since you know the position dependence of it, which is fixed by conformal symmetry, you can read off just from the expression of your correlator the dimension, for example. And we saw kind of an example of that for the dimension. We saw that the dimension is essentially appears in the power law of the two-point function. So if you compute the two-point function, you know the dimension of your model. Okay, so let's do that. So conformal invariance implies the following: that the correlator should not change if I evaluate it using, if I make this conformal transformation. So if I evaluate it with O or O tilde fields. So in formulas, what this means is that another way of writing it, I write it in a way that will be more useful for me to make calculations, but is the same as the same correlator where I replace tilde, the tilde acting on the operator with the untilde operator. So, but of course, evaluated at the same point. Okay. So this is a statement of conformal invariance. You fix a set of points, x tilde 1 to x tilde n. And you say that if I compute the correlation functions with the transformed operators O tilde, I should get the same as if I compute them with the original operators. Notice that I could have, doesn't matter. I mean, people should not be confused why I have a tilde here. I could have written the same equation where here, instead of having x tilde 1 to x tilde n, I could have x1 to xn, but then I would have to put x1 to xn here. Yes?
Putting the operators in the same coordinates. Because if you are making a coordinate change, the same point of space time, you have.
No, because, well, so that you have to be careful, though. But when you look at the path integral, what you're doing is just transforming the operator, not the coordinate. So maybe one way of seeing it, is that clear? Or should I elaborate on that? So all that you're doing is just mapping. You fix your point, and now you're mapping O at that point, and you replace it by the transform field at that point. I mean, you can see it from the path integral. Just write down the path integral representation. So imagine now we have a theory that has a Lagrangian description, where these O's are some basic fields in the theory. and write down the path integral for this correlator. And use the fact that O tilde transforms like that. And you precisely show this. Maybe I should give this as an exercise because it's important that you work it out. To see that you're saying, why am I putting this here?
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe what I said in words, you can just do it as an exercise. Just write down the path integral for this guy, express it for this guy. And you'll discover, use the transformation, you'll discover that it's given by this. And so maybe that this will be a good tutorial problem for today. It's completely straightforward to do, okay? But intuitively what you do is you fix your set of points. Whenever you have a symmetry and you replace the operator at that point by the transformed operator. More questions? Okay. Okay, so now we just use that formula, right? So we have that this guy, since we know that how this guy transforms under a conformal transformation, is just omega x1 to the delta 1, omega xn to the delta n, and now we have all these transformations. So this is the term of conformal invariance. So now essentially what this tells you is that if you want to solve for the position dependence, you have to relate the correlator of the same set of operators. Now notice that these guys are untilded and these ones are also untilded. Evaluated at some set of points is related to the correlator of the same operators evaluated at a different set of points with some non-trivial transformation kernel. Okay, so now let's use this maybe looks a bit abstract. Let's work out a few simple examples of to flesh out what this is, what kind of physics we construct from conformal invariance. So let's start with the scalar operators so that we don't confuse ourselves, because there are two things going on here in a conformal transformation. There are things that have to do with that know about the scaling dimension of the operator. And then there are things that have to do with Lorentz transformations, these L's. And for the time being, let's consider scalars, so we don't have to worry about these L's. Scalar operators. So let's consider for the scalar operators. So that means that O doesn't carry this Lorentz index anymore, it's a scalar. And let's start on the simplest type of operator, which is the expectation value or the one-point function. So the one-point function of a scalar operator of dimension delta. So now let's start using the symmetries that we have. We have translational invariance. So what does translational invariance say about this? So this should equal what? Sorry, I'm half deaf.
Is it constant?
The constant? Because by translational invariance, I can move x to any other point. Any point in Minkowski space can be obtained from any other point by a translation. So the answer should not depend on the position of the point. It should be a constant. Okay, so translational invariance implies that this is a constant, see? But now we know that the scale invariance okay, so let me write it again. So I'm just rewriting. The original equation again, okay? Sorry, this equation. But now we use the fact that under a scale transformation, x tilde equals lambda x, we have that O tilde of x tilde is lambda to the minus d. O of x. Okay. So all that I'm using is this transformation for a scale transformation. So here you get a power of lambda. And this is a scalar, so it doesn't do anything. So you just get this. But this implies, if I now use this equation, that lambda minus d times c equals c. So what this equation implies is that c has to be 0 except for delta equals 0, which corresponds to the identity operator. So, okay, to summarize, what means that the expectation value of a scalar operator O of x essentially vanishes for any non-trivial operator. And that's just a consequence of conformal symmetry. The point is that it's incompatible to say that the one-point function is a constant and to say that this guy transforms the scale transformations. That forces C to be a constant. So C to be 0, essentially. The only way in which a constant can be invariant under scale transformations is if the constant is 0, essentially. Was the logic of this clear? Because everyone else, all the other examples will build on this very simple kind of analysis. Sorry? Sorry?
How did you get the lambda to make a delta c?
So,
yeah.
That's good, right? And now I use the fact this is the statement. Okay, so let's differentiate. So this is the rule for the transformation and the scale transformation, and this is the statement of conformal invariance. Yeah, but the point is that x tilde is, we said the translational invariance tells you there is no x tilde dependence, you just get the constant. Any more questions? Okay, now let's do something. Well, the next simple example would be to look at the two-point function of operators with dimension delta 1 and delta 2. Now, we know that translational and rotational invariance, as we discussed already last time, this tells us that this has to be a function of the distance between x1 and x2, where this, by x1, 2, so I'm going to start using this notation because it's kind of very convenient. It's just the difference between these two vectors. I have 2 points. Translational invariance means that physics can only depend between the difference of these two vectors. And rotational invariance tells you that it can only depend on the norm of the difference. And that's what I mean by this. So this x1, 2 square is just x1 minus x2 as a 4-vector square, okay? So let's write, so we know this so far. And we will see that in general, for any random theory, this could be an arbitrarily complicated function of the distance. But conformal invariance gives you a very elegant and simple function. So now let's use the constraint of conformal invariance. Which is the correlator of the transform fields at a set of points is the same as the correlator of the original fields at the same point. And now yes, we already know how this guy transforms, right? So I can write this guy as lambda to the minus delta 1 plus delta 2. So now I'm using it. Okay, so here I used translations and rotations, or Lorentz transformations. Here I'm using now dilatations, because I'm only focusing on a very specific conformal transformation. This is the conformal transformation induced by a scale transformation or dilatation. And what this tells us is that, let me do it in two steps so that hopefully everything is completely transparent. Well, okay. Maybe after a while I'll stop writing this index delta 1 and delta 2. But let me just, for this case, still do it. So this is a statement of conformal symmetry, right? This was a statement, and all now I use the fact that O transforms under conformal transformation. And now, but we know the how this function, what is the functional dependence of this correlator, right? We know that this means that times a function of x1 minus, okay, x12 has to equal a function of the same function, but now evaluated at a different point. But, okay, we're of course, this guy is nothing but, this is just the statement that I made a scale transformation, so x tilde is just lambda times x. And the solution of this equation is just that f of x has to equal 1 over the distance between the two points, 1, 2, to the power delta 1 plus delta 2, which is just the dimension of operator 1 and 2. And notice that just plugging this here, you solve this equation. Is that clear?
So you find that just by like guess and check until you find a function that obeys that property.
Well, you don't have to guess very much to get this.
Right, but this.
Yes.
So you can write down a differential equation, can't you, in lambda, and then solve that.
You can also do that.
We do that in the tutorial.
Sorry?
We do that in tutorial.
We do that in tutorial, yeah. There's another way of thinking about this that, which I think what you're referring to is called the conformal word identities, which actually we will use in two dimensions to also kind of get a different point of view on the constraints of correlation functions. But this to me is, I mean, this is the most elementary way of seeing it. So you have to guess, but guessing what function scales like 1 over lambda when you scale x, I think we can all figure that out. Just, it has to be a homogeneous function of lambda. And you can just, by inspection, find it. Also, intuitively, in a conformal field theory, everything has to transform homogeneously under scale transformation because there is no length scale, essentially. Okay, so this is the constraints of translations, rotations, and dilatation. But we know that the conformal symmetry has one extra generator, which is the special conformal transformation. And one may wonder whether a special conformal transformation gives a further constraint on the correlator. So far, what we've arrived at is that so again, you have a constant that is theory dependent that you have to calculate. But now I want to see whether a special conformal transformations gives you any further constraints. But I'll do it in a way that since conformal transformations are, special conformal transformations are very nasty, there's a much simpler way of imposing the constraints of special conformal transformation, which is by using the inversion operator. So in your last exercises, you showed that a special conformal transformation can be generated by starting with an inversion, doing a translation, and following it with an inversion, where the inversion was a transformation that mapped x mu to x tilde mu, like that, okay? So instead of checking the transformation for the special conformal transformation, which is complicated, we will just check our basic relation using by applying a conformal transformation induced by an inversion. So all that we will need is that under an inversion, fields transform like this. That's also something that you already saw in your tutorial last Friday, or last, whenever it was. It just picks up some non-trivial Jacobian factor, like that. So that means that if we now go back to our master formula, okay, maybe I should write one here. So here you get. But this guy, we already know what it is. I'll just write the x dependence part. So it's x1, 2, delta 1 plus delta 2. But this guy has to be the same as the same operator here, but with the until that operator. So that's 1 over x tilde 1, 2 to the delta 1 plus delta 2. Okay? So inversions, or actually special conformal transformations, imply this functional relation that 1 over x tilde to delta 1 plus delta 2 is 1 over x delta 1 plus delta 2 times this funny x squared. So what is this telling us? That's easy. Now we'll use a very simple but very powerful identity. I mean, it's totally trivial identity, but it's very useful in this business, which is the statement that, which you can check just with your bare hands, is just that, let me see how I want to write that. Yeah, I want to write it as, okay. So if I give you 2 points and I compute this, it gives me that. Okay, so this is kind of a basic building block that will be used over and over again. So imagine now I use that identity. Essentially what I want to use, I want to rewrite x12 in terms of x tilde. Yes.
I'm confused about this overall constant that we have. Correlation function. We're just abandoning it in some places for convenience.
Well, because it plays no role. I mean, this equation is linear in C, so I can, it drops out.
That's all. Like, it's there.
Of course it is.
Right. But we're just temporary.
Well, I mean, if you want, I can multiply.
Yeah, but that's it, right? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's definitely there. So now all that I do is I just use the fact that x12 is written in a very simple form in terms of x tilde. And from that, so I'm not going to show you all the good details, but it's well, okay, maybe just this last example. And then we go to the three and higher. I'll skip some steps here. I'm doing all glorious steps so that we are all on the same page. But after a while, you know what I'm doing, so I will be more schematic. So all that I did here, what did I do? Yeah, so what I did is I brought this guy to this side, and now I use that basic identity. So I essentially rewrite 1 over x1 minus x2 to the delta 1 plus delta 2 in terms of x tilde. But this is, using this is just x1 tilde square, x2 tilde square, x1 tilde square, to the delta 1 plus delta 2 over 2. And what this equation tells us is that this equation is true if and only if. So, and that's where the constraint of this extra constraint of inversion, or equivalently of a special conformal transformation, predicts. it tells you that this equation can only be satisfied, it's true, if and only if delta 1 equals delta 2. So what have we learned? So we learned that from just scale transformations and rotations and translations, this was the form of the correlator, but in fact, conformal symmetry gives you a further constraint. It tells you that the two-point function of two operators actually vanishes if the dimension of the operators is different. Because if delta 1 is not delta 2, the only solution to this equation is C equals 0. And it tells us that it goes like x12 to the 2 delta if delta 1, if delta 1 equals delta 2. So this is nice because it tells us that just conformal symmetry tells you that many of the operators, if they have different dimensions, are orthogonal. And in a way, in order to determine the spectrum of operators, all that you have to do is diagonalize the space of two-point functions of operators that have the same dimension. The other ones don't talk to each other at the level of two-point functions. Yeah.
Understand that thing in the box. Isn't the length of the x vector preserved?
Excuse me?
Another inversion, isn't x squared preserved?
No. X tilde squared is 1 over x squared. I mean, to show this is literally just take x1 tilde mu equals x1 mu divided by x1 squared and just repeat the difference and you'll see the differences. This really has no, I mean, I'll put that in exercise today also to check, but there is no mistake. Any questions about this, about the two-point functions? So we've seen that we've gone from an arbitrarily complicated function of the distance in a generic relativistic field theory to a very specific dependence of the correlator on the distance. And in fact, we see very nicely that one of the basic things that we're after, which are the dimensions, appears as the power law of the two-point function. So now if I give you a given field theory and I ask you to compute the spectrum of dimensions, all that you have to do is compute the two-point function and read out the coefficient of this thing. Okay. And any questions about this? Now, I mean, I'll go 3 and 4, and after that I stop. I have to do 3 because it's still interesting, and 4 is because when something new happens, and from there on, there's nothing qualitatively happening anymore. So let's do now the 3-point function. So far, we're only looking at scalar operators. Later, I will mention a few things about operators that are not scalars. I mean, in particular, I already said that in the conformal field theory, we'll always have the stress tensor. So I'll have to tell you a little bit how the two-point function of a stress tensor looks like. The point is that the answer is simple, but it's messier because you have all kinds of indices floating around that you have to take care of. But there is no fundamental difficulty in going from scalars to scalar operators to tensor operators. I'll give you a few formulas. And the point will be that actually the correlation function can be written in terms of two basic tensors, and it's just a matter of putting these tensors together and symmetrizing and anti-symmetrizing in the appropriate way. But let's first finish the scalars. So now I want to look at this. Okay. Now I don't have to do all the steps, so we already know from rotational and translational invariants that this correlator can only be a function of if I give you 3 points, there are only 3 distance vectors I can define. I can have the distance between 1 and 2, 2 and 3, and 1 and 3. We also know that under scale transformations, what appears on the right-hand side has to scale homogeneously with the power of lambda to the minus delta 1 plus delta 2 plus delta 3, because this guy will give you a power of lambda to the minus delta 1. This is a power of lambda to the minus delta 2, and this is a power of lambda minus 2 delta 3. So I can write something like this. Should I put a 2 there? So these are the three invariant distances that I can define between three points, 1, 1, 2, 1, 3, and 2, 3. And A, B, C are a known quantity so far. The only thing that we know is that under a scale transformation, since this guy transforms with weight delta 1 plus delta 2 plus delta 3, it means that A plus B plus C has to equal delta 1 plus delta 2 plus delta 3 divided by 2. So if I shift everything, if I scale x by lambda, the left-hand side is scaled exactly the same way as the right-hand side, okay? But so far here, I've only used rotation, translation, and a scale transformation. Now what we want to know is use inversion, which is kind of the pragmatic way of implementing spatial conformal transformations. Do you want to write all of this? Yeah, okay, let me go. Remember that this is what we are trying to. This is what conformal symmetry implies. And now I use the fact that we know how things transform under an inversion. I just use that formula for inversion, wherever it is, essentially this formula. So this gives me x 1 tilde square to the delta 1, 1 over x 2 tilde square to the delta 2, 1 tilde square of delta 3, times. Okay, so let me do it in two steps. Where this, but this we already know how it looks like. It has to look like that, right? So it's x1 and this has to equal this. Okay, I'm putting 1 again. There's a constant here, which in fact is, there's a lot of physics in this constant, and we will be computing these constants in actual conformal field theories. And here I get exactly the same expression as here. But now, of course, the coordinates are the transformed coordinate. And now all that you need to do is use this master formula. Essentially, what I want you to do is to replace any power like this, where I and J is either 1, 2, or 3. So there are 3 of these guys. The master formula is just this. Right? So I plug this, for every factor here, I plug this expression in terms of x tildes. And now what you have to do, essentially, to for this formula to be true, I compare the powers. So, of course, by doing this, you will automatically get the right denominator, right? But now you have to check that the powers of x tilde, if you, imagine you move this guy to the other side, you have to make sure that the powers of x tilde in the numerator are all trivial. So if we pick up the power of of x I tilde square, where I is either 1, 2, or 3, you get three equations. It tells you that delta 1 minus 2a minus 2b has to vanish. Is this clear what I'm doing here? All that I'm doing is just moving all the tildes to this side. Here I've used this formula. And now I bring also these x tildes to the other side. And now I have, since the denominators already agree, I'm just making sure that the numerators agree. And this gives me three equations, which are these equations. Which you can trivially solve. Delta 1 plus delta 3 minus delta 2 over 2. And here I have delta 2 plus delta 3 minus delta 1 over 2. Therefore, the three-point function, just to be completely explicit, and you can write it in your notes. It's something that's a constant times that's the form that the three-point function in a CFT has to take, with this funny combination of dimensions of the three operators that appear in the exponents. So any questions about this? Yes?
For the structure of this three-point function, it depends on delta 1, 2, and 3. So I just have to understand it intuitively, like if 1 and 2 are close together, x1 and x2,
yes,
it will behave differently if compared to when 1 and 3 are close together.
And this is true for x1, x2, and x3 are completely arbitrary. I don't have to...
That's right. Then, I don't know if that is intuitively obvious or not.
Well, I hope it was. I mean, that's it.
Okay, well,
so you mean this difference? Yeah.
So we have three different exponents, but when 1 and 2 are close together,
yeah,
the derivative is different from when 1 and 3 are.
But actually, if one, okay, so that's something not to explain more fully. You're talking about when you do the operator product expansion. So that means that when you bring operator 1 and operator 2 together, in fact, when you do that, you always get that the power law that you get. Okay. So if you don't understand that, don't worry, because I'll explain this later. But can we discuss maybe this later? This will be useful later. But in fact, the power of delta with a minus sign is fixed by the OPE. I mean, it's exactly the right. The guy that appears when you fuse A and B to C, in the X dependence, you have to get the dimension of A plus the dimension of B minus the dimension of the other guy. So this power is, in fact, the correct one. But, I mean, I'm happy to discuss it more. But I don't want to do it too much now because it would be moving away from things that we will do later. Any more questions? Okay, so now So far, what we have to do is compute these coefficients of the 2 and 3 point functions, or extract the dimensions from the exponents of the 2 and 3 point functions. And now let's go to 4 point function where something new happens. So the first thing that happens is that when you have 4 points, you can construct coordinates that are conformal invariant. So there exist conformal invariant, well, I call it coordinates, but quantities that in principle can appear in any correlation function. This only happens starting at 4 points. For example, when you have 3 points, there is no way of constructing a conformal invariant coordinate in this way. So that's why this feature starts appearing only at 4 points. And these coordinates are called conformal ratios, or also sometimes called unharmonic ratios. I better speed up a little bit. So the point is that the scale invariant, rotational invariant tells you that if I give you a bunch of points, the scale invariant and rotational invariant and translational invariant tells you that I can construct this object, which is invariant under these symmetries, right? Because it's obviously rotational invariant and translational invariant, but also it's invariant under dilatation because I'm canceling the lambda dependence here with the one in the denominator. But it's actually not invariant under a special under an inversion. Under inversion, what happens is that this guy looks like this, using our master formula. Okay, and this equals this, right? I'm just using the master formula. So that tells us that this ratio, even though it was invariant under the scale transformations, is not invariant under inversions or special conformal transformations. But by looking at this, can you guess which other coordinate I can make that would be invariant? I mean, notice that now if I take x1 minus x2 square, so imagine I take 4 points, so let me write it concretely. And I make this conformal transformation. I mean, what I want to say is that this particular ratio of x's, in fact, is invariant under the inversion. Is this clear? No? Just plug in for every ratio.
So you've got that ratio, you've made it, it's rotation invariant, it's translation invariant.
Yes.
And then you've used some magic, well not magic, but you've got some formula.
And the calculus,
yes. This is after an inversion, this thing is true?
Yes. I'm using the master formula.
Yeah, right, the master formula.
And now I, yes?
One thing that's not clear. When you have x tilde squared, that square is computed with the new or with the new tilde? With the
flat
mesh. Tilde?
Flat mesh. It is
yeah, but with a conformal factor or not?
No. No. See, the point here is that you get I think it's just plug in for each, take one ratio, apply this transformation to each of the ratios, and you'll see that these factors all cancel. Okay? Is that credible or yes? Okay. Okay, so that means that when you're in four dimensions, so when you're looking at 4 points, you can define, in fact, two different conformal invariant coordinates, theta 1. And yeah, there's another independent one, where now instead of 1, 3, you have 1, 4. Okay. So that means that if you now you look at the 4-point function, if I can recycle this. Conformal invariants, that basic equation that we were discussing, tells you that this can be an arbitrary function of these cross ratios, theta 1 times theta 2. So this function now is no longer determined by symmetry. You have to compute it in any given model. Times a part that you can pull out, which is essentially just fixed by scale invariants, that you can write as product. This is just a particular parametrization of xi j to the gamma ij, where gamma ij are some numbers that have the property that for fixed I, the sum of j different from I of gamma ij equals minus 2 delta I. This is the analog this is what the scale invariance tells you. This is the analog in the 3-point function of saying that delta 1, that the sum of all the exponents have to give you the dimensions. This is exactly that condition. Okay. So for the 4-point function, we come across the fact that we're going to start getting interesting functions of these cross ratios. Yes?
Can you speak on that a bit?
Yeah. Sorry? Oh, yes. Yes, thank you.
No, just me.
Yes. Thank you. And so one of the things that we will study in some examples is the explicit form of these Fs. So for some conformal field theories, we will find that these Fs are interesting functions, like hypergeometric functions. And contain a lot of information about the conformal field theory. Okay, in the last few minutes, I'll tell you a little bit about how you would do this for. So far, notice that I've only been talking about. Yes.
Sure, that you can write this that you can write the 4-point function in terms of eta 1 and eta 2. Is that obvious?
Well. The way you, I mean, to really show it, what you have to do is take this basic equation. This kind of equation, okay. But now I have four operators, and just plug in this, and you'll see that the fact that you have these very particular coordinates, you have the freedom to add any function like that, and will not affect the fact that the left hand side equals the right hand side. And the basic reason is that you've introduced some basic set of variables that are inert under the action of a conformal transformation. But that you can only define when you have at least 4 points to work with. Notice that this cross ratio does not exist for 3 points. But so maybe something that would be a good thing to check is, in fact, verify that this formula is true. Using this basic relation that the correlator of the field is the same as the correlator of the unfielded field. Any more questions? Yes.
Okay. Just to be clear, it's any arbitrary function of n at all.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Yes.
So we only call them average and magic because they are...
I don't know, I'm saying, sorry, this was in some examples.
Ah, okay.
In general, we don't know what they are. I mean, they're very hard to compute. In a way, okay, yeah. If you know how to solve this, you know everything. You know everything what this is. That's why, in a way, we also, it's sufficient to stop at 4 points, because all the other ones are contained, in some sense, no new information beyond the 3 and the 4 points. Any more questions? So in the last few minutes, I'll tell you a little bit how you would extend this analysis of the constraints for non-scalar operators like tensors. So this is a bit, I'll give you some schematic things and then maybe I'll give something for the exercises. Oh yeah, sure. So I'll show you kind of the main steps and then you can, in the tutorial, I'll ask you to fill in some of the details. So let's consider the two-point function of conserved currents. So now we're looking at objects that have Lorentz indices. And now I use the fact that the three primitive symmetries, translations, rotations, and scale transformations, just tells us that this has to go like that. So this guy has two indices. So on the right hand side, I have two the same Lorentz indices. This guy is fixed by a scale invariant. It's a statement that this guy has dimension d. So if I rescale x, this should go like lambda to the minus 2d, which this guy does. And this tensor can only depend on the difference, okay? And this alpha is an object that's invariant under scale transformation. So if I make a scale transformation, alpha goes back to itself. And now let's see. Under inversion, all interesting things come from inversion. So I'll use now some knowledge from our tutorial. Okay, I have to make an effort. Okay, I'll change notation because there are too many J's. So let me write it down and then tell you what this is. So all I did is a transformation under an inversion. Remember from the exercise that under inversion, this LAV, this R matrix essentially, this R matrix was essentially that, I think I called it J in your exercise, but you've seen this before, this object. This is just the, essentially, if you look at the inversion transformation and you take the partial derivative, you get a matrix. This was essentially the metric, right? This was the last tutorial. So these I's are essentially this, and this is a function of x. Sorry?
Second term with the x2, is that an I or a j?
Oh, sorry, yes. My knowledge I put j, but then I'm worried that it will be confused with the current, so. Sorry, this is an equal. Okay. So this equation is telling us that, and now I use this equation, it tells us the left hand side equals alpha tilde of x12 tilde divided by x tilde 12 to the 2 delta has to equal kind of this scalar part, and now you have this metric structure. You have the product of two i's times alpha, because now I just plug in the master formula that that's alpha. And that can be written as I mu rho of x1 alpha rho sigma of x1 minus x2 times I nu sigma of x2. Okay? So now we have to essentially determine a tensor alpha mu nu that has this property under inversion. And this will be the second. I mean, that was elementary to prove. The one I'm going to write down is, I mean, it's elementary, just, but it takes more than 1 minute, maybe. So let me write an important property that this I tensor has under inversion. And this will be sufficient for us to uniquely determine what this alpha is. So I'll write it in terms of a matrix notation. Essentially, what I want to claim is that I x tilde, where I now, think of this I as a matrix, okay? So this is just matrix multiplication. The formula I want to use, the second identity, is that this is the same as, sorry, what I want to say is that this formula, what this is telling us is that alpha, I shouldn't have put a tilde here, this is just alpha, that alpha x tilde, x one, two tilde is the same as J transpose evaluated at x1, I transpose, times alpha evaluated at x1 minus x2, times I evaluated at x2. This is just what this equation essentially requires from us. And the point, and this is the identity that's a bit non-trivial, is that there is a tensor that exactly has this property, which is alpha of x1, 2, equals precisely the inversion tensor, this one. So if you wish, one way to think about it more geometrically is that there is a tensor, this inversion tensor, that transforms under an inversion like a connection, meaning that what you get is it's like a conjugation. So it's like you make a similarity transformation. You have a matrix, and by changing the diagonal of the matrix, you multiply on the left and on the right by I and I transpose. Okay. So therefore, and you can fill in the details, we have completely determined the two-point function of a conserved current. It's given by something that was fixed by a scale invariant times precisely the inversion matrix. Okay? Yes?
Should there be I alpha I sync over x1 to delta?
Oh, you mean the here? Yeah, I forgot. You mean, I think you mean this, correct? Yes. But notice that this guy just takes care of itself, right? So I'm using the first identity. Tells you that the kind of the scalar part of things, this cancels with this. So I'm just left with the tensor part to deal with, which is kind of what I sketch here. And it turns out now that we know that we've identified a very nice tensor or a matrix that transforms very nicely under inversion, it turns out that any, and this I naturally has one index, right? So it's a natural object that you would use when you have a vector. But now any tensor can be obtained by just multiplying many vectors together. It has lots of indices. So when you have a tensor here with many indices, what will appear at the right-hand side is a product of all these I's with the right symmetry and antisymmetry properties that the tensor has. And since the stress tensor is kind of an important gadget, let me just write down the answer for it. It's completely fixed by Lorentz symmetry and the fact that the stress tensor has to be symmetric and traceless. So that tells us that T minu evaluated at X, T rho sigma evaluated at Y. We already showed at the beginning of the class that the dimension of the stress tensor is D. And here what you're going to get is some funny tensor, alpha mu nu rho sigma of X minus Y. But the point is that we can construct it very easily from this I using the fact that it has to be made of something that transforms nicely under inversion, and it has to implement the symmetry properties of the object on the left. So it has to be symmetric traceless under mu nu and rho sigma. So in fact, this alpha mu nu rho sigma is nothing but I mu rho of X, mu sigma of X. So here, okay, I'm thinking this is a function of X now, okay? And now all I have to do is symmetrize. So under, say, exchanging rho and sigma, because this has to be symmetric in rho and sigma, so I have. But I'm not done because T minu is traceless, and this guy is not traceless. But the way to make it traceless is just to remove the trace. 1 over D, delta mu nu, delta rho sigma. So this is the most general two-point function of the stress tensor. And here, it's conventional to define it. So if I define things this way, there is a constant here, C. T, okay, C. Which plays a very important, as we will see, plays a very important role in conformal field theory. C is called the central charge of the conformal field theory. It's kind of one of the quantities that characterizes the conformal field theory. It's part of its DNA. In two dimensions, there is a unique central charge. In higher dimensions, there are more because you can construct, when you look at higher point functions of the stress tensor, you can construct other conformal invariants out of these I's that you, in two dimensions, you can only construct one. And so now essentially, given this information, given that you know this formula, and I should have this formula, you can now write down the two-point function of any tensor, essentially, tensor operator. In order to construct the three-point function of an arbitrary operator, I would have to introduce some other basic object. Let me just tell you in words, and maybe I'll put it in the tutorial. No, let me not erase that. So a place where this object will appear would be for example, if we compute the 3-point function of an object which is made of two scalars and one vector, so just by Lorentz symmetry, there'll have to be here some vector that you can cook up given the data of 3 points, x1, x2, and x3. The ratio here, of you will know how to do because we already did it before. So the powers here you know from our previous exercise. And this mu is kind of the last basic tensor that has nice conformal properties from which absolutely everything else will follow. 17-point function of whatever, you'll be able to write the right-hand side by suitably using the i's and the z's, okay? So just for concreteness, where the z mu, which is a function of these three variables of 3 points, is, well, one way of writing it is the x3 derivative of the log of x3 minus x2 square, x3 minus x1 square. So let's just compute it. So this is x1 minus x3 mu divided by the you can show that under a conformal transformation, transforms very nicely. So clearly, this is an object that will appear whenever we try to implement conformal invariant because this is the basic vector object that transforms simply under conformal transformations. Okay? Very good. So maybe I've already gone over time, so maybe I should stop. But essentially, next time, I'll start the class by just listing a few examples of conformal field theory in 4 dimensions where to immediately then jump to 2 dimensions. The reason being is that in order to study conformal field theory in 4 dimensions, well, first of all, they're less tractable than in 2 dimensions because the conformal symmetry is weaker. But also that in order to discuss them, we'd have to perhaps introduce more heavy machinery like supersymmetry, which is the basic machine to construct conformal field theories. But that's something that you will see later in your supersymmetry course and ADS-CFT. But in any case, I'll start at the beginning with some simple examples, some that are old from the studies of critical phenomena in the 60s and 70s. And then we will move on to 2 dimensions where we will use conformal symmetry essentially to solve some CFTs in 2 dimensions. So I'll stop there. Any questions?
Yeah.
Oh, no, okay. Here is what this A, B, C. So these are the quantities that we already computed before.
Yes.
Because that part of the analysis, so whenever you look at the correlator like that, there is a part which is a scalar part. The scalar part we already did. So these coefficients are fixed just by... But, and then here you have to work with the numerator, right? Yeah. So I was just getting this. Okay.
So is a conformal field theory automatically inversion invariant? Because we keep using this inversion tool to dictate our 3, 4, 5 point function.
Yes.
And I thought it was only inversion, translation, inversion invariant. So
yeah, so here I'm using it as a trick not to deal with the math of the case.
And is there some way to show that?
So there are theories with fermions that it's just like there is parity. Well, there is no parity in the world, but there is parity in the Lorentz group. But in theories with fermions, you can break parity. So So there are, I can cook up models for you that inversion would be broken.
So then there is this analysis.
No, but then it would go through, but I would have to do it in a more painful way.
Okay, but still at the end.
You get the same answer.
Okay.
But I did it this way, but it's painful enough.
But if you inversion, it's only transformation.
Yes, but parity is also a Lorentz transformation, but it's broken in nature.
So, but then we don't have control.
No, you have symmetry under the connected part. So remember, I had infinite continuous transformations that were connected to the identity, and then I had this wild transformation that not zero to infinity.
Okay, so it's only really, when we say conformal, we say we mean under infinitesimal.
Yes, and the analogy with the Lorentz group is that in the Lorentz group, when we mean it's Lorentz invariant, we usually mean invariant at what's called the proper orthogonal Lorentz group, which is the one that is connected to the identity. Whether it's invariant under parity and time reversal is something that you that depends on the theory. There are theories that there are and there are theories that are not. The standard model is not. More questions?